Hello, ex-party people. Just wanted to take a step back in time this week and re-release an episode that we did a few years ago with Dr. Alan Berger. It was 12 Essential Insights for Emotional Sobriety. And it was his relating to his book, 12 Essential Insights for Emotional Sobriety, Getting Your Recovery Unstuck. So I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you have a great week. 12 Essential Insights for Emotional Sobriety. I am Carl. I am an alcoholic addict, like a German Shepherd dog. And my sobriety day is August 22nd, 2014. And I'm here with
Alan Berger. Hi, Carl. It's good to
see
you.
Wait. No, see, such humility. Hold on a second. You're Dr. Alan Berger.
I'll be Dr. Berger now.
Okay.
I'll be Dr. Berger.
Well, what do you call somebody who has a PhD? What do you call him?
Well, you call him doctor. You do call him doctor. And I've called him a lot of other things. Some people with PhDs, but we'll stick with the doctor stuff. We'll keep that part quiet.
Yeah. So, PhD, what is a PhD stand for?
You know, a PhD is a doctorate of philosophy. Doctor of philosophy, and it's the highest degree you can get at a university.
So you're a professional bullshitter? Is that how
Yes,
that works?
Some people say that PhD means it's piled higher and deeper, right?
Piled higher and deeper,
right? I mean, so you're right. That may not be lost on me.
Awesome. Hey, you know, my wife told me not to waste your time, so I'm not going to waste your time anymore. But here it goes. I'm going to do the intro really quick.
SoberPod.com. 366 fucking days sober. Yeah. Sober pod, keep it authentic, no facades. If it's real, then you know it's ours. Welcome.
Sober Pod is a podcast dedicated to the idea that one addict or alcoholic helping another is crucial to building a life in recovery. Join us this season as we read from our book, 366 Effing Days Sober. And as always, stay active, stay sober.
Dr. Alan Berger, I'm going to read your bio here because I want people to know this stuff. This is your fifth book that we're talking about, 12 Essential Insights for Emotional Sobriety, Getting Your Recovery Unstuck. Was it released in June?
It was released in June. That's correct.
And that's on the Fourth Dimension Publishing's flagship publishing project. The publishing person wrote that. Anyway, so Dr. Berger is a top-selling author of 5 previous titles, like 12 Stupid Things That Mess Up Recovery, 12 More Stupid Things That Mess Up Recovery, 12 Smart Things to Do When the Booze and Drugs Are Gone, 12 Hidden Rewards of Making Amends, and Love Secrets Revealed. Apparently, we didn't have 12 of those things, right?
There's not 12 love secrets. We were having trouble finding one of those, but then we'll get to that in another.
Okay. He's a well-regarded Gestalt therapist working in private practice, as well as a highly sought-after speaker who presents his concepts regularly at the most notable institutions in the U.S. I think that's a pretty good resume, don't you?
I'd like to meet that guy. Where is he?
Dude, who is he?
I guess he's here today.
Okay. So we're going to, before we get to talking about the book, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and I guess why you wrote this book in particular?
Well, look, all of this, all of my work is really grounded in my own personal recovery, Carl. My journey started back in 1971. I went in the Marine Corps when I was 17 years old in 1969, came back from Vietnam, joined the Marine Corps. I was a full-blown alcoholic, teenage alcoholic, blackout drunks, all that kind of stuff. Blackouts all the time, drunk most of the time, dropped out of high school. Had to do something, right? My life was going nowhere. And I thought, well, maybe if I become a Marine, right? That might be the answer, right? It was my geographical solution. And it worked, not in the way I thought it would. But when I came back from Vietnam and I went to my last duty station, I got busted getting on the plane in Hawaii with a bunch of drugs in my pocket. And the officer at the LAX at the Los Angeles airport, he was an MP that was stationed in the same place in Vietnam that I was. And instead of arresting me, Carl, what he said is, I'm going to report you to your commanding officer, but I'm not going to put you in jail here. So I thought that meant I'm going to the military brig, man. I'm not so sure this guy did me a favor or not, right?
Yeah.
So I get there, and as I always did, man, I always schemed on, if I'm in trouble, what can I do to minimize the consequences of what the crap that I just created in my life, right? So I was always figuring out, how do I reduce, you know, the harm that I've done to myself? So I decided I turned myself in to my first sergeant, tell him I need help, because I, in the back of my mind, I knew the Marine Corps didn't have any kind of program, you know, because the commandant said Marines don't have drug problems. They just discharged us, sent us back home. I was wanting to go back to Chicago, put Hendrix back on, put the doors on, and, you know, drop another hit of acid, you know, have another drink, that kind of thing. So I did that. I turned myself in, said, hey, Top, I got a problem. He looks down, starts to shuffle some papers around on his desk, and he looks up at me and says, Berger, you are one lucky Marine. I'm going, come on, man. What are you talking about? I just told you I got a drug problem. What do you mean I'm a lucky Marine? He says, 3 days ago, the Marine Corps started a program that's going to give you amnesty for prosecution under the Code of Military Justice, and we're going to put you in rehab.
Ticket to rehab.
That wasn't part of the plan, Carl. Yeah, that was the plan. No, man. I was supposed to go back to Chicago and get the party, keep the party going, right?
Yeah.
So I go into rehab. They had no idea what they were doing. The program was 3 days old, but they turned to the 12-step community outside the base in Kailua. I was at the Kaneohe Marine Corps Air Station, and we were just outside of Kailua. And there just happened to be a bunch of young people that had found this way of life through a woman by the name of Flobird. And the people that worked with Flobird were called Flobird's Birds. And so one of them was this fellow by the name of Tom McCall. So he came out on a Tuesday night, we called it the drug rap session, to share his recovery with us and what his experience was. So you got to picture this, man. This hippie's walking in to this Marine Corps base. He's got his ponytail on, his
It's completely iconic. Yeah.
It's iconic.
That dude, we called him Bruce, actually, in my treatment center.
Bruce walks in.
Yeah.
We're standing there, our combat fatigues. This guy's coming in, you know, and he's in his standard issue hippie year. And, you know, the energy in the room was weird, man. I'm thinking, what does this guy have to say to me, man? I'm just coming back from combat. He was probably out protesting the war. And in 5 minutes, you could hear a pin drop in that room. And the reason is because I believe the other people in that room had never encountered anybody that was so real. He was talking to us from his heart, Carl.
Yeah.
And he wasn't afraid of being who he was. The level of emotional freedom and authenticity that he had blew my mind. I mean, I tell people this now. At the time, I wasn't thinking this way, but now, you know, after being in recovery for 5 decades now, 50 years, I just celebrated
50 years. That's an insane amount of time. You know, you got to realize he's like, heads were just popping across the country right now. You just killed my entire audience, right? There's cars going off the freeway. 50 years. You know, first of all, like, you know, how old were you? Were 17. How old were you in the Marines? 18, 19? How old?
I was 19 when my recovery started.
19. And so, you know, you've been sober longer than I've been. What month?
It was in August 1st, 1971.
So, literally 2 months. Oh, your sobriety is 2 months older than I am.
That just made me felt really friggin' old.
I'm sorry.
Hey, Sacra, I'm getting depressed as we're doing this.
You look great.
It's crazy to think about. 5 decades, man. It's like this. So the freedom that I saw in this guy, the only time I achieved that was when I was high or drunk. Then it was okay to be who I was. There was no other moment in my life where it was okay to be Alan Berger. I didn't like who I was. I didn't like how I felt. I didn't think anybody else liked me. I had singing to play sister. Games. I had
playing my tune.
You know, I had. I never felt like I belonged. Never felt like I fit in anywhere, man. And here was this guy. He wasn't worrying about that at this moment. He was just owning his stuff. Nobody ever owned their stuff in my world. You didn't own your stuff. You blamed other people. You got in fights. You did all this other crazy stuff, but nobody ever got real. Nobody got vulnerable. And he was able to support his vulnerability. He had a freedom from self that woke something up in me. Mm. And I knew, Carl, if I could achieve that in my life, that life might work for me. Mm. That I might be able to find a way to live this life and be okay.
So,
and that's what happened. And I started the journey with him.
So, and you started down the road in terms of generalized recovery. I mean, I actually read a lot about that in your book, which is like the whole Flowbird and that environment that you were in. And that, I mean, it's super interesting. It's great. Like, I don't know if like that could even exist today, to be honest. But I see that you definitely embraced something that a lot of others, you know, were bypassing on at that time. You know, it was, you know, recovery was not a big solution until, you know, later on. And not only that, you were in a stage where it was not cool to be an addict. It was like, or to even be a recovering addict for that matter. You know, I got sober when I was younger in like 87, 88. And like I was 15 years old when I went to treatment for the first time. And I went to AA and they were like, get out of here, son. Because I would talk about drugs and it's like, and they didn't, that was in the 80s. Like, so, you know, and then it's like, you know, it hasn't gotten, I mean, it's got a little bit better, but some meetings are still a lot like that, which is really weird. Okay. So I wanted to cover like how I found you a little bit, because I went and read Herb Kay's book, 12 Steps to Spiritual Awakening and Enlightenment for Everyone. Really helped me with my third step stuff. And actually, I got into that when the promo that I just did for the 12 Steps in 2019, whatever it was. That's when I had read Herb Kay's book. Starting off then. And it really helped me to like shift my recovery into a different gear, I think, in terms of working the 12 steps and how I related. And again, I was, you know, I'm just getting sober, man. I'm like, I got 7 years in August 22nd is what I just got.
Yeah, man. Right on,
so,
Carl.
So not 50, but hey, I'm getting there. So, but the thing is I cling to that stuff and I work that stuff now with my sponsees. I buy them that book and I say, this is how I learned it. This is how I, you know, this kind of stuff. And then I was, my friend Jeff started to, do some Herb K stuff over this last year. And so he's been doing this whole 12 step work group. And then, and he turned me on to this other video and I caught you in it. And it's just an emotional sobriety video. It was like, it's like 4 hours on YouTube. Thank you for that free 4 hours. But I was like, well, hey, who's this dude? You know? And that's when I saw a little promo for your book somewhere. And I just, I picked it up from there. And I tell you what, it really, I glommed onto it like nobody's business because of this, which is the 12 essential insights. And as soon as I read through these little insights, and as soon as I got some other information, you know, off the first few chapters, I was like, okay, I'm going all the way in, right? So it was, let me just going to read those off here. It's like, number one, waking up from our sleepwalking. Two, living life consciously. Three, discerning our emotional dependency. Four, knowing that it's not personal. Five, realizing that no one is coming. Six, accepting what is. Seven, living life on life's terms. We've all kind of heard that, but you framed it very differently. Seven, Eight, discovering novel solutions. Nine, breaking the bonds of perfectionism. 10, healing through forgiveness. 11, living a purposeful life. 12, holding on to ourselves in relationships. So from my point of view, you know, thank you very much for such a wonderful, you know, opportunity to interview you, first of all, because the book has given me just a significant opportunity to engage with myself on a whole different way, like on especially the stories and then the sentence stems, because the list that I just read off, after you read the chapter, you know, you go through and you get maybe some examples of how this affected, you know, some other people and how maybe they worked through it, or, you know, gives you some understanding of what the other problems might be. And then it gives you these, like, you know, 8 or 10 stems to write through. And so you write the stem and then you start just kind of writing whatever thought comes first to finish that sentence about 6 to 10 times. And it really gave me, it just helped me see some of my thoughts in each area, especially right after reading it, where I just didn't, it's a nice way to, for the dude who got straight ass in school and who couldn't sit still, you know, it's like, I needed that follow-up stuff. And it really did help me to to get a better handle on myself. And I really appreciated it. And I did all the work. Today, I am that dude who, like, in recovery, I don't know where it changed. I don't know when it became like the dude who wanted to cheat all the way through and to not admit and, you know, and to deflect and all that shit. Now I'm a dude that just literally reads and does what I'm told to do. And I love that stuff. So, so which gets me to the first question is, what in your own words, I guess like you have the book there in your own words, what is emotional sobriety in just layman's terms, I guess.
So if you said, all right, Al, when you did, you just asked a question, what is it? So if I used one word, I'd say freedom. Hmm. I'd say freedom. Freedom from all of the supposed to's and the should demands that we develop through life. Mm-hmm. And see, this is what hung me up so bad, Carl, is I had all these ideas about how life was supposed to be, how I was supposed to be okay, how life was supposed to be, how it should be. The mentality I had was an I'm okay if mentality. I'm okay if things happen the way I think they should. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what to do when they didn't. But I, even though I didn't know what to do, what I tried to do is manipulate you to do what I wanted, what I thought you should do.
If this doesn't work, then else if. You're really a programming language for manipulation is what you were.
Exactly. I became a master manipulator and try. And listen, that works to some degree, but there's always going to be that moment when somebody gets sick and tired of being manipulated.
Yeah.
When someone says, I've had it. I'm not, this is all about you. This isn't about me. Mm-hmm. My selfishness, my narcissism, whatever you want to call it, was so damn obvious. And so there was no room for anybody else in my life. There was no room for life in my life. It all had to fit into my idea. Mm-hmm. And so when things didn't go that way and I couldn't manipulate it, I'd object. I'd get depressed. I'd get anxious. I'd get drunk. I'd get high. Then it didn't matter that things didn't go my way. At that moment, I could have some reprieve from all of these ideas about how I was supposed to be and life was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. Didn't know how to let that go, man. So emotional sobriety, that's what it is. And how we achieve it is by unhooking all of these demands and expectations.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's a large part of that book in terms of the expectations. One of the things that I also read, because you talk about it in the book, Ernie Larson's book, so Stage 2 Recovery. I read that about 3 years ago, but my brain like was not picking up on what he was putting down at the time. It's just like I was still in Stage 1 recovery, trying to understand what the Stage 2 was even about. So I read it, though, and I picked up a lot of good language, and I think that's the other thing is I picked up the language, and I could talk a good talk in the meeting, right, if I needed to, but I really didn't feel it and have it digest. It's what my sponsor talks about. He says living from the outside in rather than from the inside out. And so
you could use that as a definition of emotional sobriety, man. Oh, it's learning to live from the inside out. The way I say it, another way of thinking about emotional sobriety is that it's really growing up. Mm-hmm. You see, we start off in this world in a very undifferentiated state, right? When you were in your mom's womb, just like I was completely dependent on her. Yeah. She was feeding me through the umbilical cord. I was, inside of that womb. She was protecting me. She was giving me everything I needed.
My mom called it a parasite. I don't know about you, but
the truth is that we are a parasite, right? Okay, we're living off the other person.
Yeah, but she kept calling me that well into my 30s.
that's another problem. But there's truth to it, right? She didn't know how to deal with somebody being so dependent on her. And that's an issue for a lot of people. Trust me. But you know what's interesting about it? The minute you were born, what you did and what I did is we took a breath. And at that moment, we started our journey towards self-support, towards growing up. Mm-hmm. Nobody had to tell you to take that breath. You wanted to because you wanted to be what you could be. Mm-hmm. And so we inhaled, we exhaled. Now, life on a biological basis moves us in that direction. We start moving away from dependency to now supporting ourselves, taking care of ourselves. Takes a hell of a long time to grow up. Listen, sometimes. I treat a lot of people. They got these boomerang kids. They launch them and they keep coming back, right? I mean, kind of a deal. Because it's tough growing up, because the truth is, biologically, it's instinctual. No one told you, hey, Carl, get off those hands and knees and start friggin' walking. You've been crawling around this house too long. It's time to get up on your 2 feet and walk around.
I was still in my 30s when that was going on. Yeah.
Well, listen, there was plenty of times when I was drunk, I was on my hands and knees and crawling around. Exactly. I mean, we know that one.
Exactly.
But no one tells us that. We want to walk, man. We want to walk. See, we want to be what we can be. That's true emotionally. But with emotions, we need some help to learn how to cope. And so our parents pass on the best that they know, which is never enough.
Yeah.
You know, I love the way Dr. Theodore Isaac Rubin says it. He says, we're victims of victims.
Mm-hmm.
We're victims of victims. Nobody's at fault.
Yeah, I just going through ACA recently, I finally got to move from that point of view, right? Where I was like, oh, you know, my poor parents, you know, they really just did the best that they could. I got to actually part of that program. I had to call my mother and interview her about my dysfunctional family tree. You know, so I did that. Yep. And and you know, I got a lot of insights in what, you know, her life and what happened to, you know, where that bruising, you know, happened.
That's right.
Her.
That's right.
And, you know, where that brokenness started. And that really got me down a lot further in terms of forgiveness and really understanding where that comes from.
Yeah. When you start to get that, you see that Virginia Satira, pioneer in family therapy, had a great little guided imagery she did with people. She goes, imagine our umbilical cords were never cut.
Mm.
And if you want to understand where this stuff comes from, man, just trace that back.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you'll get a sense. It's we're getting this stuff passed on from generation to generation. Hopefully our generation, your generation, my generation, we're starting to change some of this stuff. We're healing some of the wounds that never got healed, right?
Yeah.
Is that we've picked that up, man.
And I hear a lot of regret from, I mean, and I even said the same words myself, like, where was this when I was in, you know, from 20 to 25, I was sober. And again, I achieved stage one recovery, because that's what we're talking about here, which is stage one recovery is just getting physically sober. We get our feet underneath us. Maybe we get some stability. Maybe we get a job, our car back, you know, maybe the girlfriend
stage one.
Thinks we're just like, you know, acceptable to sleep with every once in a while, those types of things, you know, and we think that that's it. And I hear that from a lot of dudes. I got off a phone with some dude in Florida and, hi dude in Florida. I got off with a dude in Florida who's three, four months sober, I think, and maybe even more. And he's calling me saying, is this all that there is? You know, I get up, I go to work, I go home, I pay my bills, I, you know, go to meetings. Is this it? And I'm just like, no, man, that's not all. You know, there's so much more. And
so much more.
And I thought like the same thing. I really did at, you know, at those points. I remember thinking back, like, is this all that there is? You know? And I was still fighting with my wife. I was still fighting with my bosses. I was still fighting with people. You know, I was still flipping people off on freeways, right? You know, and it was not an acceptable way to be. And I needed more. So stage one recovery for me was about not being that dude that flipped people off on freeways, right? I'm still not perfect. I still move into stage one. But the idea here is that, like, stage two is really about more about that emotional sobriety. It's really about cracking that part of the onion, right? Peeling off for that layer.
You're right on. And see, the way that Ernie said it, and I'm a big fan of Ernie Larson, you know, may he rest in peace. But he said that stage two recovery is about learning how to make our relationships work. Mm-hmm. And he says it's paying attention to those patterns and habits in our emotions and behavior that caused us problems in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this is about. The first part of achieving emotional sobriety is becoming aware. That's why I started out the book about, hey, we got to realize that, man, we're asleep. We're not going through this life paying attention to what's going on. I call it selective inattention. We don't see what we don't want to see, right? Mm-hmm, that's just not going to do it until you commit to your growth. then you're open to seeing what you don't want to see.
What did you call that? Radical. What did you call that again in the book?
Radical responsibility.
Radical responsibility. Yeah.
Radical responsibility, man. Yeah, it's like we need to see who we're not if we can become what we can be. If I see who I'm not and what's missing in me, then I can see how I need to transcend where I'm at and now add to my development. See, transcendence is not becoming a new person. It's changing who we are. I'm always going to be who I am. Mm-hmm. I'm still an addict inside. Trust me, man. I have no doubt in my mind if I go back to drinking or using, all of that hell is going to come back in my life. I know that whatever it is that I don't have that ability to drink and use like a normal person. That's gone in me. Mm-hmm. So I know that's a part of me, but I've transcended that. Now I've added this whole thing of recovery and I'm not interested in drinking and using anymore. That obsession, that desire has been lifted. Life's too damn exciting and fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this discovery stuff, man, is cool. And I can hear it in your voice, Carl.
Yeah. I used to say I was, I drank for unconscious time. Right. And then I had somebody say on Facebook, like, what is the number one thing? You know, they do that stuff on Facebook. They want you to answer the stupid question. It's like, what's the number one thing about sobriety that, you know, that you like today? And I was just like, well, and instantly I was like, the consciousness of my existence. Like, just the fact that I like am aware and here today and that I am not, you know, desiring to check out for not a second. I don't want to be, you know, I was even talking to my sponsor the other day about my ice cream obsession. And I was like, I love like this little pint thing, you know, every night, but I hate having things control me. Today, I really do not appreciate having that ice cream control that behavior. Okay. So, so some questions I want to get to. How do you know if you're emotionally sober?
Well, I think it's in terms of how you deal with life. See, it's not about a lack of getting upset, but it's what you do when you're upset. Mm-hmm. So if I'm emotionally sober, that when I get pissed off at you, I start looking at what my expectation is instead of looking at what an idiot you are.
And so instead of which might be true, but what about like, well, you're saying like, if I'm focused on others, when I'm feeling bad, it's kind of like that acceptance, you know, the 4:17, right? It's like, you know,
right. So
I should look at myself if I'm disturbed.
Right. If I'm disturbed, Bill said it. It's a spiritual axiom. Every time I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with me. Now, emotional sobriety gets at the what's wrong with us, right? That's the issue here. And what's wrong with us, as Bill so clearly saw when he was doing his own work on his depression, is that what's wrong with us is our emotional dependency. Mm-hmm. That I'm expecting you to be a certain way for me to be okay. I'm expecting a situation to be a certain way for me to be okay. So back to that, I'm okay if mentality. Emotional mm-hmm. sobriety is when you get to, I'm okay even if things don't turn out.
You said that in a book a couple times. It's like, what is it? Say that again. You're saying like, I'm not, what's this?
So the first part is my emotional dependency creates an I'm okay if things go the way they're supposed to go.
Okay.
Emotional sobriety is I'm okay even if things don't go the way that I think.
An even in there.
Still, you put an even in there and then you learn how to deal with it and grow up. Instead of demanding that the situation is different, we now change.
Mm-hmm.
I change how I'm coping with it. I change how I'm dealing with the situation. That's where we start to grow ourselves.
And so to skip out of all that altogether, because my next question, you really, you talked about it a little bit. This is one of your videos I actually spotted. It says, I first heard the term a spiritual bypass in ACA, and it's in the ACA Big Red Book. And can you talk about like what a spiritual bypass is and what it means in relation to emotional sobriety? Because I think you had a really good point in that video. And I wanted people to hear this, especially because our audience is, and no offense, audience, if you're one of not the other people that I'm talking about, like our audience is consists of believers, agnostics, and atheists for a reason. You know, we started this podcast with that idea, and then we all get along and we all came at this stuff from different points of view. And I think that you had a really good point with the spiritual bypass, because I actually see this a lot in people. I see them that run around this with the spiritual bypass idea. Can you explain that?
Yes, I'd love to. And see, the way I came to understanding the spiritual bypass is because I asked the question. Bill wrote this letter in 56 that became published in the 58 Grapevine. And I know millions of people have read Bill's letter. But why didn't it spearhead the next major development in AA? How come only now in the last, I'd say, 5 years or so, is there's now this critical mass that's starting to develop around this emotional sobriety? What happened? And then it hit me. I was reading John Weldon's book, right, about spiritual awakenings and stuff. And he talked about that if we use spirituality to bypass dealing with our emotional trauma and the other messiness of life, that we never grow up. Mm-hmm. So it's like this idea, and I'm not putting anybody down that doesn't. If this works for you, keep doing it. But when I say I've got a problem and I'm going to stick it in a God box and God's going to solve it, I've now abdicated an opportunity or missed an opportunity to grow myself up. Mm-hmm. God's going to do it, not me, right? It's that kind of a thing. And now I'm not, look, once again, I'm saying, look, if that works for you, keep doing it. But what was missing in it is, what do I have to do? How can I use God's grace or whatever it is to grow myself to better learn to cope? See, that's the issue here. And that's what he called, what he saw with people that used these spiritual principles to avoid dealing with their own issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you had a point where it said, like, it takes you away from actually doing the work.
That's right. That's exactly it, man. It takes you away.
Yeah.
I don't have to cry about my pain. I don't have to do it. I'm going to go ahead. I had a good friend of mine, Teresa Taduri, and she worked with Marianne Williamson for a long time. She goes, I got to a point in my spirituality that I would forgive you before you even did anything wrong. I mean, it's like, wait a minute, that's not how it works.
So I guess, do you ever achieve emotional sobriety? Do you ever, like, is it something like, you know, is it something ethereal hanging out there?
Well, you know, I think it's back to this idea that, you know, our program is about spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. Same thing here. This is about progress. Emotional sobriety is a practice, just like spirituality is. You know, it's something that we continue to grow ourselves. And look, I'm a lot better today at being able to deal with situations that would baffle me before. That's the promises that are made to us, right? In the ninth step, right? We're going to start to learn how to deal with situations that used to baffle us. I see that happening in my recovery. So I do believe that this is about progress. I believe, but once we get these ideas, what we do achieve is that we stop blaming people. Mm-hmm. And Bill made this point so clearly, Carl, is blame, the word blame has to be dropped from our language.
Yeah.
Whether we blame ourselves or somebody else, it doesn't matter what dirty shoe you put that, or what foot you put that dirty shoe on. We got to get rid of the dirty shoe. Blame is irrelevant. What's relevant is taking responsibility. And the difference is blame marshals up defensiveness. If I start blaming you something, hey, wait a minute, am I that bad? But when we take responsibility, it's about empowerment. Now we start to look at what we can do to and how we can learn from the mistake we made instead of beating ourselves up over it. I'm not going to be perfect. That's why I put that chapter in. We got to let go of this perfectionism.
Yeah, definitely. And I am riddled. I think I was just listening to that emotional sobriety YouTube video I was referring to. And it was talking about, like, I think Herb K said, I think like 80% of people come in here or something like that. 60% have issues with perfectionism, you know, which I think I can see it in a lot of people, you know. One of the things I want to thank you for, like chapter 6, which is like the big aha moments, which was knowing it's not personal. Yes. And then the other one, which is the next chapter, I believe, like like knowing that nobody's coming, like nobody's coming to save me. Like I, yes. And actually you spelled it out really well. Like knowing it's not personal, which is cool because it was like, if you're negative to me about, you know, whatever you, Carl, I don't like your shirt or, you right. know, whatever. I, you know, of course, like, you know, I'm like, well, whatever. Like, I mean, I take that personal, right? No doubt. But here's the thing is like, what I really didn't get to see is that how much I take that personal. And then the other thing is, but if you said, Carl, I really like your black shirt. See, it's, you know what I mean? It's like, though I never understood like how, you know, not taking either one of those things personal. I really don't have to. Like it's your opinion. It has nothing to do with me. And I didn't, you know, you like or dislike my black shirt has nothing to fucking do with me. And I love that shit because I didn't really get it until it became positive, right? Like, Carl, I like your black shirt. And I was like, oh, I get it. When reading that, they gave me that aha moment. That's and right. then the other thing, nobody was coming, is that, you know, what did you say? You like walk into a, I don't know if you said like, what if you walked into a, is that another video maybe? Walk into your, what if you walked into your therapist's office and, or you, maybe that's what it was in your therapist?
It was. Yeah. So, that's right. Yeah. So Dr. Nathaniel Brandon.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of his. I've read a lot of his stuff. We also lost him a number of years ago, a little bit before we lost Ernie Larson. He used to have a sign over his door and it said, no one is coming.
Yeah.
And so they'd be doing the work because he promoted personal responsibility. He says, look, no one's coming. I'm going to try to help you figure this out, but you're going to have to learn how to cope with the situation. Nobody's going to come along and make this okay for you. See, that's that emotional dependency thing.
The
emotional dependency also creates that reflected sense of self. See, if I'm emotionally dependent on you, then I'm constantly looking at you for approval or disapproval. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so that's why I'm taking things personally. I'm saying, well, how are you feeling about me now? Yeah. Now, how are you feeling?
How about now?
Me?
How about see, now? I'm so, I'll be, yeah. How about,
can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Right. Yeah. But that's what we're doing with this emotional dependency. We're so focused on the world to see if we're okay.
And we're so tuned in. You said it so well. You're also talking about like, you know, organizations like AA, right? Like, and not to bag on it, but you know what? I think a lot of people put this huge dependence on that as well. And that's the thing is it's another tool for us to use in our recovery. It's like, you know, and it's, you know, it's sometimes it's not good for some people, right? Like they get all culty about it or whatever. But I'll tell you, the way that you frame that too really helped me to see like how much to emphasize that not only for myself, but for others, right? That nobody's coming. And I really love the sentiment behind that. Okay. So I don't want to take up any more of your time. You're the busiest dude.
No. But yeah. I wanted to say one thing about the AA thing, because that's such an important point. See, Bill said this in his letter in 56. He goes, I had to cut off my faulty emotional dependencies upon people, upon circumstances, and even upon Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people read that and went, wait a minute. Now, weren't we told when we came in the program we're replacing one unhealthy dependence on drugs, including alcohol, for a healthier dependence on AA
and all of the
wonderful stuff? Bill says, you guys got it wrong. AA is not to make you more dependent. It's to help you grow up. Mm-hmm. And see, he even said that in the 12 and 12 and 50 when he wrote it, because he got it at this point in time, that the purpose of the steps, the explicit purpose is, yes, to achieve physical sobriety. We need that. There's no question about it. We got to get clean and sober.
But then he said
the purpose of the steps is for you to begin to achieve emotional sobriety. Mm-hmm. So these steps are designed to grow us up, to help us learn to stand on our own two feet, to learn how to take care of ourselves so that we become the determining force in our lives. Mm-hmm. And once we do that, then I don't need to look at people and places to make me okay, because that's my job, not yours.
Exactly. I can go anywhere I need to go now, and I don't need anybody else otherwise.
You got it, man.
And I love that. I love that. Love that.
It's so powerful, man. It really sets us free. And that's what I always wanted. Just like you said, you achieved unconsciousness, and that unconsciousness, I would say, was your freedom. And what this does is it helps us get that freedom and remain conscious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I don't want to take up any more of your time again. Thank you for your for your time.
Oh, listen, honestly, this is not like, taking up my time, Carl. I love doing this with you. I want to say I love what you're doing. I love the message you're carrying out here.
I'm excited
about this stuff. These are not just ideas for me. Trust me when I say I'm living by this stuff. And that's why I really believe it, because I've seen the impact it's had on my life.
Yeah.
And that the life I'm living today, man, there's a lot more freedom in it than I've ever had before. And thank you for giving me this opportunity to share my work with people.
Oh, thank you. You know, and I do want to encourage everybody. There are going to be links in the show notes to go get this book. Again, 12 Essential Insights for Emotional Sobriety. It's available if you're on Kindle Unlimited. It's available on Kindle Unlimited, but you can't read it on your Kindle. You can read it on your desktop or your iPad because it's a PDF. So I just wanted to make sure people understood that. But otherwise, it's like $9.99 or something like that. Is that what it is on Amazon?
I think it's $19.95 for the book. And
$19.95.
The Kindle is Kindle's
$10.
$10.
So you're worth every penny. I bought the physical copy so I could make notes and highlight and do all the things that I do. You know, and I could drag it around and my wife can see that I'm actually not reading porn.
she appreciates that, but she's really learned not to take it personally even when you do read porn. She says that's about him, not me. That's nothing to do with whether I'm attractive or not. He's getting himself off.
That's about him and candy. and then again, buy this book. I guarantee you, if you have any length of sobriety and you've gone, maybe you've gone through some of the 12 steps, this is going to be a benefit for you. If not, just, get it and hold on to it. You know, after you finish your step work, you can jump into this as well. Sure. If you're like me and you were, going through, 12 steps and you were still a little lost and wandering and maybe you joined an ACA and looking for other solutions, this book is going to help you as well. You guys know that I don't do interviews like this with authors or other people like this. So I actually called up Alan specifically to get him on the podcast because I really felt that he had something here that, people could benefit from. And I know that I have. So I just want to make sure that everybody knows.
Thanks, Carl. And Carl, this book is really a result of the workshops Herb Kagan and I have been doing over the last, I'd say, 20 years.
Nice.
Because I took all of the stuff we had been talking about and I credit Herb for this in the foreword. And we have been really digesting this thing and really, really trying to put these ideas together in a way to help people take the next step in their recovery. And that's what this is about. This is the next step, man.
Yeah. And it's definitely worth the price of entry. That's for sure.
Thanks, Carl.
All right, brother. Thank you, guys. If you want to give a shout out to anybody in particular, I would give a shout out to you.
Who? Shout out to Herb Kagan, man. Herb, thank you for all the time we spent together on this and stuff like that. And Vince, thank you for helping me edit. This is the best book that I have written. And a large part of that is to do with my great editor, Vince Hyman.
Awesome. And thank you, Herb, for helping me with step 3. Just saying.
There you go. Good shout out to Herb.
All right.
See you guys. Take care, Carl.
SoberPod.com. 366 fucking days sober. Yeah. It was a sight to see them. Yeah. Breakfast was Sprite and Seagrams. Wrestling with my vices, exercising my demons. My blessings were blocked, so I never got the message. I'm stressing, I'm only 12 steps from an exit. Damn. Regret it, because my imperfections were perfected. I ain't run from it, I accept it and rep it. It's a badge to me. Good stories come from a tragedy. And when you survive, the glory will come in Act 3.
Three.
The wait's over. 366 fucking days sober.
Read it.
Morning affirmations that can start the day for you. Use my favorite book. Mark for a placeholder. Finish when the day's over. Okay.
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 Okay. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Sober pod. Keep it authentic. No facades. If it's real, then you know it's ours. Welcome.
Welcome.
Welcome. Are you a rebel seeking transformation in your recovery journey? Then 366 fucking days sober is the book for you. 366 daily meditations. This book by the SoberPod Recovery Podcast host and professional rebel, Carl, will help guide you towards a new way of thinking and living. Each daily meditation offers a fresh perspective, practical advice, and a healthy dose of Carl's irreverent humor to help you stay sober and embrace the challenges of life without drinking, drugging, or shitting your pants. Whether you're just starting your recovery journey or looking for a daily dose of encouragement and laughs, 366 fucking days sober is the book for you. So,
If you're ready to transform your life and become the rebel you were meant to be, get your copy of 366 fucking days sober. Today.
Available today on Amazon.com.